Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show I do where I talk about the things that I've seen since the last time I did one of these. It's just me, it's just David, and once again, we are in the middle of the great BP Movie Journal catch-up. I'm into the second week of January is where I left off last week, so I'm going to try and get through a lot of the movies that I've seen as much as possible, try to catch up to the present, because I won't be able to do another movie journal for probably a little over a month. So this is just the way these are going to go from now on, my schedule. Listen, with my schedule, I cannot journal movies. So let's get it. We don't want to say that. Let's kick things off with, I've already forgotten the director's name, Paul King's Wonka. It was not a Paul King. I was familiar with Paul King from his work directing the Mighty Boosh series, but I hadn't seen any of his movies, and Wonka did not make me any more likely to see any of his movies. It's the kind of movie where I'm just like searching for something nice to say. Like, I like the idea to set the movie in the dead of winter. There's a really cool part where like wood panel comes off of a building that overlooks a frozen river, and it falls to the ice and crashes through the ice into the river. That's very cool. Those are the things I can think of. Mostly it was just that everything I feared in this like way too cute, sickeningly so, like eating too much candy. Backstory of a character whose backstory I don't care about. Let's move on to, so I didn't really expect to like it, and I didn't. Let's move on to a movie that I did expect to like, and I feel like I am on the outside, looking in here. Raven Jackson's All Dirt Roads Taste of Salt. This seems like a movie that'd be tailor-made for me in terms of, the approach, the very sort of poetic, not overly concerned with narrative approach, the sound design, the patience and lushness of the cinematography. Everything seems like it's right up my art house alley, but it just felt really unoriginal. It felt like it was like all those things I just described, it felt like it was aiming for that in kind of like a, as if it were like following a diagram to make that kind of movie. I really felt bummed out by how I felt about it, because I went into it so excited, and maybe that was the problem. Maybe I should have, lowered my expectations. I don't know what to say. Okay, moving on to starting this episode with three movies I didn't like, but the documentary American Symphony, directed by Matthew Heineman, I very much did not like it. It feels, I mean, I said it's directed by Matthew Heineman, but it feels like it's a documentary about John Batiste, and it feels like he's in the captain's chair. It's doing too much of allowing him to tell his own story, as if we're just like present at a like lecture and Q&A that he's giving or something. It has very little curiosity, which is what I want. Compare that to a great documentary. Finally, get to move on to something good. Joe Brewster and Michelle Stevenson's Going to Mars, the Nikki Giovanni Project. This is about the poet Nikki Giovanni. And this is a really fascinating portrait of a person who is an artist out of time, if that makes sense. She's thinking like steps beyond what the people she encounters in the film are. It becomes almost comedic in its portrait of the sort of narrow way we want to define artists, but not just artists, black artists, queer artists, female artists, all of which Nikki Giovanni is. The number of times someone during a Q&A, not the filmmakers, are just watching, it's less of an interview type of thing, at some sort of Q&A or whatever, people are trying to get her to talk about her trauma because they assume that, like, well, you're a black queer female artist, your work must come from your trauma, from your suffering. And she, like, she doesn't even get angry about it. She's just like, she doesn't know what to do when those questions come up. And she basically just tries to move on. But it's really fascinating, a great portrait of this person, and also it functions as a portrait or as an illustration of the limiting ways that we, the narrow scope through which we view artists who come from oppressed groups or beleaguered backgrounds or these sorts of things. We want them to fit our version of a victim or something. Really fascinating. Okay. I'm not going to talk too much about the next one because it was on my top 10, so you already heard me talk about it. But Sean Price Williams, The Sweet East. I found it fascinating. I would be willing to watch it again, though, just as a straightforward comedy, because it's very funny. I've talked on the podcast, on the individual achievements, I talked about how good Talia Ryder is. I guess I'll just mention once again how good Simon Rex is as well. He's turned out to be just such a fascinating actor. Okay. Next up, I took a break from all of the end of year catch up back here in January, and I watched for the first time for myself John Huston's The Misfits, which was Marilyn Monroe's final film and also Clark Gable's final film. This is what happens when watching movies so long ago. I'm losing track of the specifics of what I wanted to say, but the movie is mostly, like, the first two-thirds are not bad at all. Just Marilyn Monroe kind of as a recently divorced woman who's kind of adrift, falling in with this group of freelance wild horse trappers or whatever. It's definitely interesting, but then it really comes to life in the final segment of the film when it's just Marilyn Monroe, Clark Gable, Eli Wallach, and Montgomery Clift, and she's agreed to tag along out on this, like, horse hunting. I don't want to say hunting because they don't kill the horses. They trap them, I guess, and they rope them and they take them into town to sell them. On this trip and out in the desert, it's really fantastic, and everything gets against that sort of desert backdrop. Everything gets to be larger than life, and Marilyn Monroe's character sort of having maybe a kind of breakdown or maybe a breakthrough, and it's happening against this backdrop. It's really good. And Clark Gable, it's fascinating. Like, he died of a heart attack before the movie even came out, which is sad, but also fascinating because his performance in the movie is so physical. I guess I'm just thinking, like, he seemed like he was in great shape when he made The Misfits. But I guess you can have a heart attack even when you're not in great shape. I don't need to be blaming people who have had heart attacks. I'm sure their doctors do that too. It's not fair. Okay, another movie I'm not going to talk too much about because it was on my Through the Cracks episode, but Giacomo Bruzzese's Disco Boy. Just another great performance from Franz Rogowski. The guy does no wrong. And it's definitely a... Like, I'm going to repeat the things I said on the Through the Cracks. It's definitely a politically minded movie, but it's not at all dry or strident or anything like that. It's very intoxicating, hypnotic, and dreamy. Really liked that. Next up is 1971's Bushman, which recently directed by David Schickel, which recently got restored, and it's about a Nigerian in San Francisco in the late 60s while the Nigerian Civil War is going on, and this guy is kind of like representing his country to the people he meets, but to some people he just represents blackness, but in some people, to some black Americans, he represents Africanness. He's like, he wants to advocate for his country, but he's always sort of like at the whim of how other people see him in some ways. Yeah, cool movie. Let's see. After that, I went, got a chance to go to a screening room, excuse me, to revisit Jean-Pierre Jeunet's Amelie, a movie that I had loved when it came out, seen a couple times, bought the DVD, that sort of thing. Hadn't seen in 20 years or more, and have become not a very big fan of Jean-Pierre Jeunet. So I went in a little nervous. I was like, I know this movie's going to be cool looking, and Audrey Tautou is obviously very charming. I think this is the one movie of his that I've seen that he dropped that sort of distancing malevolence or like sneering. I feel like he tends to position himself above his characters in a way that makes them less interesting for me. But here it feels like he as a filmmaker is being as vulnerable as Amelie eventually must learn to be. And there's so I've said before that some of my favorite works of art, like, you know, walk the tightrope of maybe being super embarrassing. Some of them are super embarrassing, and I think Amelie kind of could fit that. Let's see. Next up, Nikolai Arcel's The Promised Land, which I was eager to watch, mostly for the fact that it stars Mads Mikkelsen, who was also in A Royal Affair, which is the only other Nikolai Arcel movie that I've seen, and where I first, I think, my math and my memory and timeline is right, that's where I first became aware of Alicia Vikander. But she's not in this one. It's Mads Mikkelsen, and there is a supporting actress who's very good. Her name's Amanda Collin. He plays it's a roughly true story about a Danish retired military officer who is given a patch of land to sort of till and work, but the local aristocrat family, especially the son, sees that land as theirs, even though it's government land, and spends the whole movie trying to force him off of it. It's pretty, like, sort of standard. I mean, I don't know if this is made by a studio in Denmark, but it feels like that a work at that sort of budget and level. But Nikolai Arcel is a talented sort of journeyman director, and the movie's well made. The Danish title is Bastarden, which I think means bastards. Okay. Then I watched Alexander Payne's The Holdovers. And I mean, opposite of Alder Road's Taste of Salt, I kind of went in thinking I wasn't going to like it. More like, yeah, like Wonka. I went in thinking I probably wasn't going to like it because I don't really like Alexander Payne, except, like, not since maybe About Schmidt. I don't really like him. I mean, Downsizing is at least, like, bizarre enough to hold my attention. I don't really like him, and I didn't really like this. You've heard me talk about it on the podcast, I think, but it feels like it has an idea of the movie that it wants to be, and those movies already exist, and it's just trying to mimic them, and as a result, none of it feels very real. Then I watched, okay, I was doing my, like, 2023 catch-up, and I watched a movie, excuse me, that I thought was a 2023 movie, but it turns out it came out in December of 2022, and that's, let me look at the director, Gerard Johnstone's Megan, and, yeah, I thought it was fine. I don't know, I think I was looking for something that would maybe get a little bit more more weird or more like go for broke in some ways, like not worry about we being weird. And yeah, it's just kind of a, I don't know. It's a horror movie. I've seen horror movies. That's so dismissive. All right. Wes Anderson's The Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar. This, I've watched it twice. This is like crack to me. Just the dialogue, the incredibly fast talking, the way the film is both like feels handmade, but also like clearly that a lot of money was spent on this at the same time. It's just so, so charming, and I'm a Wes Anderson guy now after years of not being. Let's see, William Friedkin's The Caine Mutiny Court Martial. This was in my top 10 of the year, so you've already heard me talk about it. I absolutely loved it. I'm trying to think of something to say about it that I didn't say before. Maybe I'll say that, like, it had been a while since I've really remembered how good Jason Clarke can be. I know he's an Oppenheimer, but I saw this. No, that's not true. I saw this after I saw Oppenheimer, didn't I? Jason Clarke is arguably the lead of the movie. And he's great. That's what I have to say about that I didn't already say. But yeah, it's one of the best movies of the year. Next up, Hirokazu Koreeda's Monster. This is, unlike our friend Scott, I like movies about kids. And Koreeda has made a number of them. I don't know if this stands necessarily with, you know, Nobody Knows or I Wish, which are both movies that I really love, but still that sort of that kid's eye view of the world, an actual kid's eye view, not like the like pandering Hollywood like wide-eyed innocent kid's eye view, like the kid's eye view of like the world doesn't entirely make sense and I don't understand my place in it yet, but I can also find little worlds within, I can find my own worlds within the world. I don't want to say, because like I guess there is kind of a spoiler element to the movie and what it's about that I will leave to you to discover, but definitely worth checking out. Next up, Anthony Chen's Drift. Wanted to like this, didn't hate it. It's just Cynthia Erivo is a woman who is I guess homeless, living on a Greek island where it's mostly, there's a lot of tourist traffic, and she's just, yeah, I guess the title is fitting. She's adrift. Aaliyah Shawkat plays an American who lives on the island and gives tours in English to tourists, and they sort of strike up they do kind of strike up a friendship, and that's the best stuff when it's the both of them, I think, because the solo stuff, I think Anthony Chen doesn't get the naturalism that he's going for. It feels too much like a story that he's putting his thumb on the scale a little bit. Another movie about kids that I really liked, Totem, Lila Aviles's Totem. This is kind of an all-in-one day movie about a family who is throwing a birthday party for the patriarch of the family, who is probably dying, but it's told through the eyes of his very young daughter, and sort of allowing us to wonder how much of what she's seeing she understands in a way that's very, very touching. Christopher Borgli's Dream Scenario. No, thank you. I don't know what, I mean, this movie's in love with itself, but it does not, it's way too, in love with its own premise, that Nicolas Cage plays a guy who's a regular guy who suddenly starts appearing in everyone's dreams. And it wants to be, it very clearly wants to be a comment on the nature of fame, of viral fame, and how, as Nicolas Cage's character becomes famous, he sees it as like a springboard to accomplishing the things that he's always wanted to accomplish but hasn't. But really, when you're famous in this way, people are only going to see you the way that they already see you, and therefore, you know, you either have to steer into like being, you know, the damn Daniel guy or whatever, or just let it run its course and go away, because if you try to force your reputation, it's going to work against you and destroy you. I'm getting through a lot of these. I hope this is interesting to you. Next up, a movie from, why am I now forgetting, Chile. A Chilean movie called Fist of the Condor, which is a martial arts movie, but it's in Chile, and that's the, it's not trying to be, I was going to say that's the hook, but it's not trying to be like hooky. I like the movie. It is both paying homage to the history of martial arts movies, but also making it's sort of geopolitical and historical elements specifically Chilean and specifically referencing like the native population of Chile and the history of oppression and colonization and appropriation and stuff like that. Good movie. You want a really good movie? I don't know how to say this director's name. Vuk Lungolov Klotz's Mutt. This is another all in one day or all in 24 hours movie about a young trans man whose father is coming to visit him, and he has to get a number of things in place before that happens, and then has to, like, obviously his father knows he's trans, but they haven't really seen each other, and so there's that to navigate as well. And yeah, I use navigate because maybe negotiate is the word. It's really about the idea of transition, not the actual like physical effect, but the idea of like in terms of the space that you occupy in the world, transitioning from one way of being seen to another, and how do you bridge that if there are things from like pre-coming out and pre-transition that you want to take with you? What are the difficulties that you have to negotiate to get that? But it's all in the package of this like kind of hectic 24 hours in this dude's life. Really liked it. Okay, another movie that I'm not going to talk too much about because it was on my, I think it was my honorable mentions in my top 10, but Bosch Davis's Here, which is just a lovely movie about two people who are both not from the place where they are connecting, a Romanian construction worker and a Chinese botanist, biology student, something like that, who meet in Brussels and kind of just hang out. And it's a lovely movie about connection and but also about place. All right. Next up, Elizabeth Chai, Vasarhely, and Jimmy Chin's Naiad, which I'm looking at Letterboxd and seeing I gave 3 stars to, which is, I've said before, is damning with faint praise. But I think I remember it a little bit better than that now that I think about it. Maybe I was too harsh on it at first. But I mean, maybe like 3.5 stars. I'm not saying it's great. But it's a great couple of performances from Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. The directors have made documentaries about, you know, they made Free Solo, they made The Rescue. So they really know how to get across the sort of peril and the difficulty of Diana Nyad's kind of like struggle against nature and against God himself, if you will. But yeah, well acted and well shot. I don't think I'm a big Reese Ifans guy. Yeah, that's what I'll say. All right. Okay. The Oscar-nominated animated film Nimona is gratingly obnoxious to me because it's so sure that it's so funny, and none of the jokes are funny. I did not laugh once the entire movie. Just a dreadful experience for me.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Okay. I started this, or I watched the first half last year, the first part last year, so I figured I should finish up the Indian film Punniyin Selvan. This is part two. Part one came out in 2022. Part two came out in 2023. So I finished it. And I'm not versed in Bollywood enough to know like where this falls in terms of quality. It definitely feels well made, and there are definitely some exciting sequences. But then also like comparing it to, because 2022 also saw RRR, and this is also in a historical action epic, so it's hard not to draw some comparisons. It's also, there's, and it doesn't live up, but there's also, it's a really dense story. I couldn't entirely keep up with all of it, partially because like I watched the first half a year ago, so I didn't necessarily remember everything. I almost feel like I'm not qualified to talk about this movie because I don't have a Bollywood like background. So let's move on to another Oscar, I think an Oscar winning documentary, Mstislav Shernov's 20 Days in Mariupol. I put off watching this one because I was just really afraid it was going to be very harrowing, and it is. And but I'm still glad that I watched it. The thing that is really fascinating about it, it's not just documenting the immediate days of the Russian attack on Ukraine and the attack on the city of Mariupol and the things that happened there. It is documenting that, but also a surprising percentage of the movie is about the filmmaker's difficulty in getting their footage out of the city because everything's cut off because of the attacks. And because of that, the movie ends up kind of being an argument, a pro like video journalism argument, saying like, here, these images that you're watching are important, and you wouldn't be watching them if we didn't do our damnedest to get them to you, which I guess sounds like they're patting themselves on the back, but really I think they're standing up for all video journalists. It's kind of reminded me of a documentary called Burma VJ, which is about some like really brave independent video journalists. Check that out. I don't know where you can find it, but check it out. Okay, I'm gonna burn through a few here in a row because these are the Oscar-nominated live-action shorts. So, The After, starring David Oyelowo, completely not worth your time at all. It is a movie that has an absolutely terrible thing happen at the beginning and then doesn't seem to do anything with that. Except watch like someone suffer for a while, and it just feels like it's wallowing. It's kind of exploiting, I think, the tragedy of like some sort of public mass murder. It's no good. Let's see. Red, White, and Blue is a document, or not a documentary, is a short film starring the incomparable Brittany Snow. I like her. She's great. It is a movie about someone who has to travel across state lines to get an abortion. And it is, message-wise, I'm very much into it, but it's also so very, like, obvious about his message that it doesn't necessarily make for great, I don't know, filmmaking. You know what I liked, though, is a movie from, let's say, Denmark. It is Denmark. A short film called Night of Fortune, which is about a man who is at some sort of, I don't know if it's a mortuary or something, but like he's supposed to be there to look and give the final kind of okay, I guess, on his late wife's body before she's buried or whatever, say his final goodbyes. And he can't get up the courage to open the coffin and look at her. So he ends up like wandering around and meeting, because I guess this is like I said, some sort of mortuary. There are other people there doing the same thing. And he sort of meets other people who have also recently lost loved ones, or maybe not so recently in one case. I really liked it. It's very, obviously very dryly funny, given the subject matter. It couldn't be a romp, but it's definitely has a lot of gallows humor and dark laughs in it. It also has moments of incredible beauty and sort of connection, and the idea of like sometimes being near other people, even if you don't know anything about them, is what you might need. Connection means something. All right, next up, Vincent René Lortie's Invincible. This is a French-Canadian movie. It's based on a true story of a teenage boy who committed suicide, sadly. And it's definitely very well made. To compare it to something like The After, which is also a very upsetting movie, I'm not sure Invincible has that much more to say than The After does, but it has empathy, and it's well made and well acted. It's still not, you know, it's not great. I still like, I'm like, I don't know if I needed to know that. Like, thanks for sharing, I guess is how I felt about it. This story, I'm not sure. I'm sure it was cathartic for the filmmaker, and maybe that's enough. And then Wonderful Story of Henry Sugar again, still great. Okay. Excuse me. I watched, the Albert Brooks documentary Defending My Life, and I learned some things about Albert Brooks, but probably could have learned more by watching his movies. Okay. Moving on to the animated shorts. Now these are good. Except for one, which you already heard me talking about. So the first one is Yegane Moghadam's Our Uniform, which is kind of a, I guess, it's sort of biographical, memoiristic. It's about school uniforms in Tehran, or in Iran. And there's just narration telling the stories of the uniforms and what you had to wear, what you couldn't wear, what would happen, you know, you get in trouble if you didn't wear the right thing and stuff like that. But it's all animated with like live action sort of still shots of pieces of the uniform, and then they animate things, you know, moving around on them or over them or walking. You know, you've got like one of the school teachers like walking along the sort of strap of a dress, or a shift, whatever you would call it. Really cool. Okay. Letter to a Pig is very upsetting, but and fantastic, like, sound design too, but it's from the point of view of a girl who is being, whose school is being visited by a Holocaust survivor, and he's telling the story of a pig that meant a lot to him while he was imprisoned, it starts depicting these things more or less literally, but then it gets into the story as he's telling it, but then it also gets into her mind and the things that she is thinking of while he's telling the story. It's, yeah, really good, kind of almost stream of consciousness animation. All right, the next one, another very heavy one, Pachyderm, directed by Stephanie Clement. This one is gorgeous to look at, immersive, warm, because it's about a girl who spent every summer with her grandparents, and so then we're spending time in the countryside, but things don't go so well for her. I don't want to give too much away. It is, like I said, it's very upsetting, but it's also very beautiful, which that juxtaposition, I think, makes it all the more upsetting. Let's see. 95 Senses. This is directed by Jared Hess and Jerusha Hess. So, like, the fucking Nacho Libre people made this movie about, again, like Letter to a Pig, rather. It's about an old man telling a story. And it animates the things that he's talking about. But it's probably the funniest of the... Yeah, definitely the funniest, because they're so heavy. It's the funniest of the bunch, but it's also... there's profundity in it, and yearning, and existential questions, and I just... yeah, I really, really dug it. All right. So. Oh, and then the final one was my worst film of the year. War is Over, inspired by the music of John and Yoko. It's god-awful. It's insulting. Blah. That's the final one of the nominees. But the nominee, or the package they put together, I guess they felt that the animated nominees together are still so short that it wasn't worth, people wouldn't feel it was worth the price of their ticket. So they added a couple more. There's a really cool one called Wild Summon, narrated by Marianne Faithfull. That is just the story of wild salmon and their life journey, being born in the river, going out to sea, living in sea, coming back to the river to spawn and then die. So it's about the life cycle of a salmon, but it does it by, shooting all, like, live action shots of all of this stuff, and then putting really well made, really advanced computer generated salmon human hybrids in the water. So we can, I guess the idea is that we then project humanity onto the salmon by picturing them as humanoid. But it's also, like, really, disturbing, because disturbing things happen to salmon. Yeah, really cool. I liked it. And then there was one that was just a waste of time called I'm Hip, which is just a song about it's supposed to be like, I couldn't believe this is from 2023, because it's supposed to be like a send up of a certain type of hipster, but I feel like that person hasn't existed since, like, the Swingers era. Like, I mean, the Swingers, the Doug Liman movie. So I don't really know what it felt, just hopelessly out of touch and unfunny. Okay. Next up is About Dry Grasses, which I, have already talked about. And, Yeah. I don't know what else to say. It's fantastic. It's amazing how Noribilgo Sailan, the director, can hold your attention with these long shots. He trusts in his actors. He picks the right framing and the right sound design. I feel like I've been talking about sound design a lot, but it's a really important part of movies, guys. And also making its main character he's a pathetic man, not to be envied, but there's also, it wouldn't be entirely untrue to say that he is probably one of the types of people who would watch a movie like this. And so there's a little bit of, not audience condemning, but there's a little bit of connection there. And then, Julio Torres, the comedian, comedic actor, his directorial debut is called Problemista. He plays, a Mexican immigrant. I can't remember what country he's from, living in New York, who is about, gets fired from his job, which means he's going to lose his work visa. So he has to find a job, and he finds a job as an assistant to a art critic played by Tilda Swinton. And the movie's, Tilda Swinton is kind of the main reason to see the movie. I mean, I like Julio Torres is good too, and obviously he wrote this, so obviously he's part of it. I'm not saying it's just Tilda Swinton's performance, which I love, but I mean that it's also the type of character that she is. And on an upcoming episode, we'll air in just a few days, Scott and I are going to talk a little bit about Ingrid Goes West and how, like, perfectly it captured a certain type of person. And I feel like Tilda Swinton's character in this movie is a type that exists, and I mean this an exaggerated version of a type that exists, but it gets to a type of person that exists and mocks her, but in a loving way, and really captures it captures a type of personality very well, and with a lot of laughs. So Problemista, quite liked it. Movie I couldn't believe I liked. I did not like Bird Box. Susanna Bier, I think, directed Bird Box. I didn't like it. So the fact that there's a Spanish language spin-off or sequel called Bird Box Barcelona, I thought it was just going to be more of the same in a different language. But no, this, unlike Bird Box, Bird Box Barcelona is actually willing to have fun with the premise and not be just this miserable slog. It's definitely like pulpy at times, but that's preferable to the dreariness and the ponderousness of the first one. I don't think you would need to necessarily have seen Bird Box to watch it. So yeah, give it a shot maybe. All right, let me tear through the documentary short. So Nai Nai and Waipo is director Sean Wang, a portrait of his two grandmothers who live together and are friends. And it's just really, really cutesy and not really for me. But Sean Wang directed a movie I saw at Sundance called Dee Dee that's great. So that's out there. The Barber of Little Rock, directed by John Hoffman and Christine Turner, is a sort of bio-doc about a man who has made it his mission to help the Black community, especially in Little Rock, with like self-finance their own businesses and home purchases and stuff like that, and get the opportunities and just the loans and the trust that the mainstream banks won't give them. Well made. He's a very compelling person. So yeah, good for that one. Island in Between is really fascinating. Directed by S. Leo Chiang, it is about Thailand and how and its relationship with mainland China from the sort of 40s to the present, and also the filmmaker's relationship to both Taiwan and mainland and China. I found it very touching and personal. The one of the documentaries I really, really didn't like is the ABCs of book banning. Obviously I'm anti-book banning. I'm definitely politically on board with what the movie is saying, but the just like having kids read from banned books and then like say the darndest things about them is so cloyingly cutesy. It is so very much not up my alley. But speaking of cute kids, the now Oscar winning The Last Repair Shop, directed by Ben Proudfoot and Chris Bowers, loved it. Just fantastic. Really, because it's not a movie that is telling you how to feel. It is getting to know these people. It's about four of the people who work at who work repairing instruments for Los Angeles United School District students. That's their job. There are bands all over the school district. They need their instruments taken care of, and so these people do that. And then you also get to meet kids who play these instruments. But really, it's mainly the four adult characters, and we meet them one by one. So the movie is 40 minutes long, and it's basically like 4 10-minute segments of getting to know these people and getting to know the backstory. And so, like, as much as it is like pro music in schools, and it very much is, it almost feels like it could take place anywhere. The point is that everyone has a story, and it feels so trite, but this movie is so warm and open and loving about people that I'm glad it won the Oscar.